You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up in this week's Parish Council, Taylor Swift and Spotify. Griffith Jones threatens to leave the country if Labour win the general election. Don't call Griff, please. The media and mental ill health issues, University Challenge reviews, and of course the pretend soapbox.
Hello everybody and welcome back to the Parish Council, your podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw and remember, you're a Womble and he's Terence Dacham.
Yeah, it's not a good idea, Ed. It doesn't matter what Ed Ball says. Oh, hello Magnus Shaw.
Oh, are you on the phone again?
Yeah, I was on the phone there. It's Ed Miliband. He's asking me for some advice. He's seen the headlines this morning, but he's thinking of changing his name to Ed Farage.
I don't know.
Well, I said I'd call him back.
Yeah.
And let him know. So yeah.
Well, he'll probably be available over the weekend. He won't be busy, will he?
He may not be busy. Now, I don't know if you've all noticed, but that Taylor Swift, she's got a new album on release. She's kept very quiet about it. Of course, it's entirely up to her how she sets her music free upon the world. But one place you won't hear 1989, her new album, is on Spotify. Nor will you find it officially, at least, on YouTube. No. In fact, Taylor Swift has removed all of her music from Spotify. Yeah. Well, she has the first million-selling album now of 2014, which in itself is an extraordinary statistic that it's taken to November for an album to sell a million. But, you know, I'm wondering whether this means that Spotify's 40 million users and YouTube's 1 billion users will contribute to those sales figures as they're forced to record stores or Amazon to hear Taylor's album.
This seems like a commercial decision. I know no reason's been given, has it? It's just happened. They've just been all pulled. But I guess it's a commercial decision. They famously, Spotify offers peanuts, very small peanuts, in return for your material being on Spotify. But you think with someone like Taylor Swift, those peanuts would add up. You might as well be there. I think there's this misconception by the recording industry and artists that if you appear, well, particularly on a pirate site, but also if you appear on Spotify, then those people that listen to your music that way are people who would otherwise be buying your CDs. But that's just not true. I mean, I may well listen to some Taylor Swift on Spotify, but that doesn't mean I'm going to go out and buy her Real World CD from WH Smith's or one of these modern outlets. This is the argument about piracy, isn't it? Somebody was arrested for posting, I think we spoke about it, a Vin Diesel movie online, and Hollywood, or the studio said, well, the fact that this guy distributed the movie online had cost them whatever it was, $80 million or something. But that is predicated on the notion that people who would watch it for free, if they couldn't get it for free, would buy it, and I don't think that's necessarily true.
I think you're right. It's an interesting move, and it would appear to be working in the short term due to the strength of those sales figures. This is what she said in the Wall Street Journal. She did an op-ed piece that I believe she wrote herself, Taylor Swift in the Wall Street Journal. Music is art, and art is important and rare. Important, rare things are valuable. Valuable things should be paid for. It's my opinion that music should not be free, and my prediction is that individual artists and their labels will someday decide what an album's price point is. That's the end of the quote. But I think the issue for Taylor Swift and other artists with this philosophy is that, I think it's similar to what you just said, in that all diehard Taylor Swift fans have been forced into buying her album either in physical form or on iTunes. And this has led to this huge hit of sales in this first week. But I'm betting that sales will drop equally dramatically because people who just like Taylor Swift, someone like you or me, but aren't exactly exuberant fans, again, someone like you or me, won't buy the album, but you and I would have listened to it on Spotify, as you said, and probably would have returned to play particular tracks that we enjoyed. And you see, this is the thing, this is Spotify's argument, that would have given Taylor Swift long-term income instead of the big splash of those first week sales that then dip off, as, you know, it traditionally now happens with boy bands' singles. you know, all the girl fans zoom out and buy them in the first week, and then nobody else does, and it drops.
And then not least of all those X Factor downloads that you get on a Saturday night. So
absolutely.
Every unit shifted will be on that Saturday night, and the same principle applies.
Yes, it's not quite an impulse purchase, but it's a purchase made on an emotional wave of joy for the artist in that particular week or day or hour.
And only a small window in which that enthusiasm has any effect on the sales. Yeah, exactly. Funnily enough, I when I saw this on the running order, I checked into it. I listened to two Taylor Swift songs on Spotify yesterday. So,
oh, just before they were pulled off?
No, they're still there. Well, I mean, they were up to about midnight last night. So their people haven't been quite as fastidious as she might want them to be.
I think there was talk of one or two tracks being left up there that she didn't have control over that had been used on film soundtracks.
One was from a romantic. No, what was it? I don't know. Yeah, one of these compilations that you get for playing in the car type of thing.
Yeah, they'll still be up there because, you know, they've been licensed out and her record company don't have control over that.
But well, that's all right. That was the track I wanted anyway. So.
Sure, but the new album and her back record. Of course, this is the Spotify pitch that instead of initial burst of income that tails off, artists can generate money through streaming over decades. But where Taylor Swift's point struggles, I think, is that I went to a leading illegal file sharing site. I did.
Were you on the dark web?
To be honest with you, and I know you're joking, but you know it's not. It's so easy. Yeah, it's the most famous one of all, and it's so easy to find. The point is, I was overwhelmed by options of downloading the extended version of Taylor Swift's album for free, albeit illegally. Yeah, yeah. Of course, I chose not to do so. I wouldn't do that. But
will you let me have a rip of it later, though?
streaming, you know, was killing piracy because you didn't need to go to this famous illegal file sharing site, because what would be the point? You could hear it on Spotify. Why bother going to all that hassle of downloading an illegal stream, illegal file?
Yeah, it worries me greatly that recording artists are using words like price points.
This
doesn't speak well of the position of pop artists in this day and age, that they're talking like economists. I think that's quite concerning.
It is, and it, you know, it obviously remains to be seen in the fullness of time whether Taylor Swift's strategy works. But it doesn't seem to have worked for the, and it's a very limited one or two artists who pulled their work. Your mate from Radiohead, Tom York, is another one who's famously against the Spotify concept. But whether they like, you know, that particular example, that particular company or not, streaming is here to stay.
Of course.
And the deniers like Taylor Swift, who, as I say, I like and admire. You know, I think in the end, my view is that you know, all of this work will be back up on streaming sites with the long tail of income.
I agree. I noticed Prince has taken all his videos off YouTube as well. For a thing, I needed to watch the video for Gold by Prince. And I recalled a few weeks previously, I'd done just that, and it had gone. It had gone.
But you can guarantee that within, I was going to say 10 minutes, but more like 10 seconds, both all of Prince's videos and, indeed, you can this morning find individual tracks of Taylor Swift's new album on YouTube. because individuals will post it.
That's right.
And, you know, there's a billion YouTube users around the world, so it only needs a handful to put the videos up, and the chain is broken.
Yeah, it's all a bit futile, isn't it? What it does indicate, I think, is that the music industry is yet to find a model to replace the one that they had before, because everybody's doing something different. You mentioned Thom Yorke. Radiohead tried giving an album away. They've tried selling an album, but you name the price. Thom Yorke's taken all his stuff off Spotify, etc., etc. Everybody's doing something different in order to rearrange the deck chairs on that famous ocean liner.
But not one of them is changing the direction of that liner. You know, they might be moving the deck chairs around, but the liner is still heading towards the iceberg.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And that's why somebody somewhere needs to draw together the big movers and shakers and say, how are we going to sell music in the future? Obviously, lots of different ways, but all these actions are reactions and negative reactions at that. Taking your music away is not a solution to sales in the music industry, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. Now, you know, we heard from your Ed Miliband a little bit earlier on. each time a general election draws near in the UK, we inevitably hear pop stars and TV and movie stars squeaking, really, about how they will leave the country if Labour wins at the polls. Andrew Lloyd Webber, Paul Daniels, Phil Collins, they've all said they would leave the UK prior to earlier British elections. And, of course, many would have happily contributed to their airfare. But this week, Griff Rees-Jones has said he would leave the country if your Ed Miliband and your Labour Party win the next year's general election, due largely because your Mr. Miliband wants to bring in a mansion tax. Now, I'm sure you want Griff to stay, so no doubt you'll be changing your vote, Magnus Shaw.
You're taking a massive leap in the dark on the assumption that I will be voting for Mr. Miliband, which is not necessarily the case. I don't know why people do this. You're right, to list those celebrities who said that. and I don't know why they say it. They might as well say, I won't be voting Labour, I won't be voting Tory, whatever it is, and everybody would say, okay, that's interesting, you know, you've nailed your colours to the mast there, you've voiced an opinion, all well and good. Why do they leap in with this sort of pantomime melodrama of leaving the country? Because, A, that's it has an inherent conceitedness about it, in that it's a threat that my fabulous persona and enormous contribution to British cultural life will be withdrawn if so-and-so happens. And B, more importantly, they never do it. They never do it, regardless of the outcome.
Except for Phil Collins, who decamped to Switzerland.
Yes,
we've got to give him his due.
I wonder why. It was, he must have been delighted when he moved to Switzerland and just, you know, a few months later realised there's a low tax regime in that country. He must have thought that was a tremendous coincidence.
Quite a lucky break.
Yeah, a real lucky break for him, yes. I cock a snook at your Griff Rees-Jones because I think he's talking poppycock and no need to say it. And if he left the country tomorrow, it would be of no consequence to really anybody other than Mrs. Griff Rees-Jones, I guess, and the little Griffs that they may or may not have. This threat that I will withdraw my, you know, bountiful contribution is embarrassing, really.
Jim Davison, Frank Bruno, Tracy Emin, they've all said in this parliament that they would have to leave us if your Labour Party wins.
I mean, just spare me. As you say, just go. You know, I will wave you off. If you think so little of the support the country and its various institutions have made, have given to your career and your bountiful success, that you will take your riches and vanish over the horizon, then let me drive you up to the airport, really.
I'm going to declare a small interest in that I've worked quite a lot with Griff Rees-Jones. Indeed, so long ago, he was my first ever producer on Radio 4, when he was fresh out of university, and he joined the BBC on some sort of graduate program, And he ended up producing a late night satirical program on Radio 4. He did then, and he does now, have a tendency towards the maudlin.
Yes, he's
a bit of a gloom.
He is. Yes, by sheer coincidence, the first television commercial I ever wrote starred Mel Smith and Griffith Jones. So that's odd. That's odd, isn't it? And Mel Smith was, let's say, of the two of them, he was the one with the hail fellow, well met approach to life, you know. Yeah.
Well, of course, not many of us. I mean, the reason why he's so concerned about the mansion tax is not many of us have had the opportunity to sell our television company and buy an enormous house in Fitzroy Square, 100 yards from Regent's Park. Mm. I mean, that might, I suppose that might alter many of our views, to be fair to Griff. A £15 million house that's going to cost him $30,000 a year in your mansion tax.
Well, yes, it's funny you mention the taxation figure there, because I believe that may have been the fee he charged for the television commercial that I made. I think it's not in that ballpark for the day's work. He did some voiceovers for the radio version and shot the TV version and went on his merry way. So he should have hung on to it, really. They could pay his tax, couldn't
he? He could have been paid it in one go. Yes, nice work if you can get it, as they say. Here's a clue, Magnus Shaw, from Tuesday's Daily Telegraph cryptic crossword. I was sitting working on this on Tuesday afternoon, 21 across. Fruitcakes from northern states is the cryptic clue. Uh-huh. The answer is found by taking the N from northern and then putting it in front of a word that means states, which is utters, you know, in other words, the state in terms of speaking. Mm-hmm. So you've got N from northern and utters. So the answer to fruitcakes in the cryptic crossword is nutters. And that gives us a little insight there into how the compiler of Tuesday's Daily Telegraph crossword views the issue of mental health. Mm. Mm-hmm. I was actually really quite shocked by that and embarrassed to be writing the answer in. It made me shudder with you know, horror that in 2014 a crossword clue would consider that was a kind of an amusing little piece of crypticness. You've picked up some other examples of how mental health issues are treated in the media.
Yeah, this all stemmed from the X Factor last weekend, the Saturday edition. We get two slabs of the, and they are slabs as well, aren't they? We get two hours on a Saturday night and an hour on a Sunday, is it something like that? Remarkable. Cheryl Cole, I'm not going to use her Vasani surname, mainly because I can't quite remember it, but let's call her Cheryl Cole because that's how we know and love her. Puts her act on, and it was crazy, wasn't it? That's right. It was the song Crazy by Gnarls Barkley. And they now get given a dance troupe to do a thing around them, don't they? They never got that with Pop Idol. On Pop Idol, they just stood up there and sang, didn't they? And now they get a dance troupe and a light show and everything. And to accompany the song Crazy, the dancers were dressed in straitjackets. And I took to social media, A, to see what the reaction was, and B, to throw my two penneth worth in. I shan't deny it. But I was surprised at how few people were animated, exercised about what they were seeing on their television screen. I think had she brought on I'll throw in a disclaimer, because I think the choreography and so on and concept is all done by that Brian fellow, and so this isn't really leveled at Cheryl Cole. It's really leveled at everybody who had any hand in this. But had they brought on a dance troupe in blackface, or had used black dancers and had them in chains, I think the world would have lit up. I think there would have been outcries, outrage, and questions asked at the highest levels of ITV, if not highest levels of the country. Put people in straitjackets and draw a stereotype from Victorian England of insane asylums, nobody seems too bothered, other than a handful of people who came back to me to say they too were appalled. So it just suggests to me that particularly in the media, there is still no taboo around the mistreatment of the mentally ill or the portrayal of the mentally ill. And that is really, if you pardon the pun, depressing, because we saw Robin Williams earlier this year, as far as we know, lose his life to depression. And did that not teach us anything? It seems not. And that really made me sensitive to this issue. And as is often the case, once you become sensitive to these things, you see them everywhere and hear them everywhere. And Anne Widdecombe appeared on the radio, I think probably on Monday. I didn't make a note of that. I think probably on Monday. And they were talking about a young man who committed an appalling crime in Leeds wherein he murdered his teacher. And she said, "We must, as a society, decide whether he is bad or mad." Well, nobody is mad. Mad is a pejorative term that has no place in modern medicine or psychiatry. So that was another example. And then there was a show, Obsessive Compulsive Cleaners, on Channel 4. But anyway, give me your feedback, because I want to mention that Obsessive Compulsive Cleaners a bit in a second. But just tell me what you think.
Well, first of all, in terms of the X Factor, you're right. It's not Cheryl Fernandez-Hassini who actually organises the dance routine.
No, that's
Brian,
right.
Brian Friedman is the choreographer.
Yeah.
But also, it would have gone through various dress rehearsals, of course, and nobody did decide, well, this is a bit tasteless, we won't do it. I've noticed this week. I noticed something that really walks down the same path as you there. I noticed that the coverage of the murder of two women and the subsequent arrest of a British man in Hong Kong this week, been in front page of most of the papers this week, has led to some bizarre headlines. And I focused on the Daily Mail. I'm not picking on the Daily Mail. I'm just taking this as my example. Mm. I've got three headlines from the Daily Mail this week. British psycho banker tried to kill himself.
Yes.
Next day, shocking pictures that show the decline of psycho Hong Kong banker from brainy Cambridge cad to bloated zombie. It could have been me. Psycho banker's ex-lover reveals her torment. So this use of the word psycho leads the reader, I think, into linking psychiatric illness with a sort of monster identity that will inevitably lead to murder. So there's two ways of looking at it. It could be, some would say, perhaps the sort of people who enjoy dapper laughs, that it's all just a bit of fun. You know, Magnus Shaw, you should lighten up. We all need to be able to laugh at ourselves. That's what your X Factor choreographers would say.
Yeah, we ought to be able to laugh at ourselves. But I am guessing that most of the people involved in that dance routine on the X Factor weren't suffering from a psychiatric illness at the time, so they're not laughing at themselves. They are laughing or making light of conditions that afflict other people. This is a parallel with the Ebola nurse Halloween costume that caused such a stir. But that caused a stir.
But you see, these things. I don't disagree with you, because I think that we do take far too lightly the issue of mental health. And I've argued before that one in four statistic is fatally flawed. It's actually one in one. We all have some form of mental health issues. And anybody who says they don't, I don't believe them, because we all at some stage or another, question, why are we here? What are we doing? You know, is it just me? You know, am I out of step? Whatever. Even if it's something as simple as that, we all have those moments.
Yeah.
But I think with these issues like the X Factor choreography, and Anne Widdecombe saying, was that boy bad or mad? I think that's more from thoughtlessness.
Yes.
I don't think it's in any way these people are trying to make some sort of statement and being flippant about mental health.
Oh, no, but that's thoughtlessness is the pernicious problem. Bullies and the ignorant are always easy to identify and to tackle or ignore. That's what I've always thought with racism, with overt racism, you know, the various parties that we could name and parties that have existed in the past, the British movement, the National Front, etc. They were so blatantly and overground in their racism that we could point to them, say, this is objectionable, they are, you know, unhinged. if I'm not treading in my own cow pat there, certainly, you know, these are extremists. I think we can say these are extremists who are here to damage our society, but the actual harm gets done when people are thoughtless and where people conduct themselves in such a way that generates a culture which is harmful to other people. That's where it becomes very pernicious.
Yes, but there's a very clear, I think, stretch of water between two issues there. One is the real diehard extremist at one level who thinks that anybody with a mental health issue should be locked up and throw away the key, and also sailing on that same ship, on that same stretch of water, are racist people who believe that anybody with a vaguely different skin colour to themselves should be sent to wherever. Mm-hmm. But right across that water are somebody, and we talked about this about a year, 2 years ago, when the John Terry case was highlighted,
right.
Is that you can make a racist remark in order to hurt someone without being a racist, and you can put people on the X Factor stage in straitjackets without personally having strong views that all people with mental health issues shouldn't be allowed on the streets. I'm not saying it's right, but there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah, equally, I'm not saying that Cheryl Cole or Brian the dance
Freeman.
Man, yeah, Brian Freeman, have conspired. All the producers of the X Factor or Simon Cowell have conspired deploy some kind of subterfuge whereby they're sending secret messages against the mentally ill. Or they've even sat round and said, man, I hate those mentally ill people, don't you? Yeah, God, I can't stand them. I know, here, this will be great. Of course that didn't happen. What I'm saying is that they had an acceptance, a social, cultural acceptance, that using people in straitjackets in a dance routine wasn't a problem. There's no conspiracy except a conspiracy of thoughtlessness and ignorance.
But and whilst it's based on thoughtlessness and ignorance, there's hope. So that my hope is that the compiler of the cryptic crossword in the Telegraph will think, actually, you know, maybe I stepped over a marker. Perhaps the handful of people who contact the X Factor and Brian Friedman may make him think again. Mm. And perhaps the people responsible for your obsessive compulsive cleaning program. Where did you see this?
Well, this was on Channel 4 midweek. Mm. And I just found it very hard to believe that anybody conceived of a program where they took people who had hygiene issues in their houses and thought they would film people with obsessive compulsive cleaning disorders tidying those houses up. This struck me as being a very, very small step away from going to see the mentally unwell at the Bedlam Asylum,
being paying sixpence for a stick to poke them.
Exactly
with.
So. But interestingly, and I mentioned this on that day as well on social media. I said it's just this. In fact, I said this is the third example in almost as many days of poor negative attitudes towards the mentally unwell. Interestingly, I was really pleased to receive this. The husband of one of the women who was there cleaning on the show got in touch with me, and he said that appearing in the show had given his wife an enormous confidence boost. She asked to go on the show. I think this is the second series, you see. She
right.
asked if she could go on the show because she had the condition. She thought it would raise the profile of people in that situation, and the production team were nothing but supportive, caring, and at every instance asked her if she was comfortable or wanted to withdraw or change anything. And I don't know if I was reading this into it, but it seemed that she'd also received some professional care, professional support, at the expense of the production company. That wasn't quite clear, but that was the impression I got. And what is absolutely clear is that her condition and her general well-being has improved from appearing. So I was somewhat chastened there. I expressed this to the gentleman who wrote to me. I still felt that the general message was one of watching people with a psychiatric or psychological disorder is some kind of entertainment, but her experience had been extremely good.
Yes, I suppose I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say just because sometimes I think the person who takes part in these things says, oh, you know, it was great for me, doesn't necessarily give it the endorsement that makes it, you know, a valuable program. I mean, were you as the viewer, I didn't watch it, were you as the viewer kind of being invited to laugh at these people? Were you being made to feel empathetic to their plight?
A bit of both, I suppose, but it was entertainment. This wasn't a medical documentary. It was, look at this person, they've got no hygiene standards, and look at this person, they're obsessed with hygiene standards, let's put them together.
It does sound a bit odd, I must say. I haven't watched it, but it does sound it doesn't sound terribly tasteful.
I didn't think
the way you're describing it.
It made me uncomfortable. Had it not made me uncomfortable, I wouldn't have raised it on social media. Because it was, I wonder what would happen, you know, there's a wonder what happens when you mix oil and water, wonder what happens when you mix a match and gunpowder. It was really, that seemed to be the thrust. That wouldn't it be funny, or wouldn't it be entertaining, perhaps not funny, but wouldn't it be entertaining to see these two people, these two personality types put together? And that made me very uncomfortable. I would be, of course, all in favour of an intelligent documentary about obsessive compulsive disorders. This wasn't that. But my dismay was somewhat tempered by learning that at least one person had benefited from appearing on the programme.
Well, I think it's perhaps a subject we will come back to, and very possibly next week, because I believe we're being asked to watch the second part of a documentary on Broadmoor. Yeah, we'll have another view, I suspect, on the way that mental health issues, perhaps a greater extreme, are being handled in the media when we watch that next week.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Okay, well, a bit of a change of mood now. Dum da 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 dum 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 do 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 do. John Simpson, Stephen Fry, Miriam Margolyes, Clive James, Julian Fellowes, Christopher Hitchens, all of them SWATs, and all of them have, as students, appeared on University Challenge.
Uh-huh.
That was the theme music I was humming at the beginning.
You need
there.
The bing bong tubular bells bit, don't you?
Bing
dong.
Bing bong.
Yes.
It's the quiz show that's run with pretty much the same format since 1962, originally hosted by the then 27-year-old Bamber Gascoigne.
Yes.
he already behaved as if he was 70 when he was 27.
Yeah, looked it, didn't he? Yeah.
And since the BBC revived it in 1994, hosted by Jeremy Paxman. The same theme tune has been used throughout, and only three voiceover men in the 52 years, and only two hosts, Bamber and Jeremy. But does this continuity lead to a warm, cosy, easy-to-watch show, or perhaps has University Challenge become a parody of itself?
It still comes over as incredibly archaic, doesn't it? Despite the futuristic set and Paxman, although I suppose it could be argued that he's in the autumn of his career now, but and all the young people and various attempts to bring it up to speed, it really comes off as very old fashioned. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Old fashioned things can have a lovely rush of nostalgia to them, but this didn't. I think it belongs to another era. I found it a really awkward watch, principally because of the not so much a Paxman's sneery. I mean, this is what we expect from Paxman. He's never been anything other than what he is, which is supercilious and a bit sneery. That really doesn't really matter to me. That, and I would guess the students probably enjoy that little bit of friction. But it's the format. It's the pace and structure. A question is asked, and then there's an inordinate amount of time while everybody ponders on what the answer may be. Alternatively, a very, very long question is asked. The answer is given is one word, and it could be wrong. I mean, it could be right, but it could be, and if it's wrong, you think, well, that was a waste of time. That took ages, and they got it wrong. So I just don't think it's a format that resonates in the modern era. I think people are too impatient. It just has these pregnant pauses all the way through it that makes it a bit tiresome and a bit awkward.
Those pregnant pauses are extraordinary, because if you're used to, for example, a quiz show like The Chase, which I know you watch and I watch from time to time, you know, there's a time element. You know, when you're up against The Chaser, it's, you know, bang, an answer goes in, and Bradley says, I need an answer. That's You've got to give an answer really, really quickly. But on University Challenge, it's, you know, and, you know, who wrote this play? And there's a musing upon it for 30 seconds until he says, come on, come on. But, yeah, he's terribly grumpy, Jeremy Paxman. I found the same with you, the discord. I found it a little bit uncomfortable. He introduces it in this grumpy manner. It's sort of describing a FA Cup match or something. But for you know, miserable people, Manchester University against the University of Sussex was the edition that we watched this week. Interestingly, Paxman, very formally dressed in a suit and tie, but both of those were absent from all of the contestants, most of whom seemed to have favoured the Primark, or Primark, as I say. I noticed it's clearly colder in Sussex, as three of the four of their contestants wore jumpers, and none of the Manchester people. But did you notice not a woman in sight on either team?
Oh, that didn't occur to me until you mentioned it just then. But they often do. I mean, I've seen episodes or editions where the team captains have been women, so I don't. I think that was just.
I'm going to disagree with you. You think that the students like. And warm to the friction. I hate it.
I can imagine. I'm thinking back to when I was a student. Say, oh, we're going to meet Jeremy. We're going to be on with Jeremy. This will be a right old.
Well, let me give you an alternative point of view, because I find it's easy to imagine him in a sort of Edwardian suit with a hefty beard,
stovepipe hat.
Yes, exactly. I feel that. He sits there hoping and praying that a student gives a wrong answer so that he can say something like, Harold Pinter?
Yes, I know, but I think the student mind would think that was riotous, Stephen.
But you see, I don't, because it seemed to me that this is like a kind of Beecher's Brook that leaves most of the... It leaves the students, I think, unwilling to take a chance.
Yeah, true, yeah.
To answer the question, and they sometimes, instead of giving a bold, confident answer, they usually answer with a quiver, a bit like Oliver Twist asking for more.
Yeah, from Harry Secombe,
they say, Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You know, with the expectation that he'll go, oh, no!
Which, of course, is very easy to do, to look vastly superior when you have all the answers in front of you.
Well, that's what I was. I long for the day when he sneers that the student who's been put down says, "Well, it's easy for you, mate.
You've got all the answers."
Card with the answer there.
Exactly. I wonder what the do you know what the audience figures are like for University Challenge? I can't believe anybody dashes from wherever they happen to be spending their evening to get home in time for University Challenge. It must be very much an afterthought for those taking part as well. I can't believe it has a huge audience, just because the pace of TV programmes has changed, but this hasn't been able to change with it, I think.
Sussex University, I noticed, couldn't identify Roxette.
I know. Delighted there was a pop music round, because they're the only ones I got right, I think.
There was a slightly older fellow on their team. We were given the average ages at the start. Yeah. University of Sussex average age was 30, and I think it was this bloke that pulled their number down.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew Naina Cherry and Enya, but again, Paxman, particularly patronising, he said, oh, thank you, because the guy identified Enya very quickly. He said, oh, thank you very much for cutting Enya short, you know, as if...
I think it was Naina Cherry that he said...
Did it? What's even worse?
Yes, I think he said... thank you for asking so swiftly. We could switch that off. Oh.
God. No, the set, the backdrop and the ambience, I thought it did lead towards a dull half hour. In rather contrast to the quiz show that follows it, Only Connect.
Which is great, I think is the natural successor. There's no reason you couldn't have student university teams playing Only Connect, could you?
I don't know. I mean, it's just such a breath of fresh air. It's hosted sparkly and with charm by Victoria and Corin Mitchell. Yep. It's lively, it's fast, it's intelligent. Yep. The contestants don't fist bump at the end as they did on University
did
Challenge.
Oh, no. I didn't pick up on that. Terrible, isn't it? The fist bump. But Pram, I'm really starting to think it's had its day as a format. I think its biggest flaw, and this is really crucial, I think, in modern television, is that you can't really play along with it because it's very academic, and the knowledge is sort of highly won, or hard won knowledge. It's not common knowledge, not general knowledge like on The Chase. And
some of you may
I'm sure you answered all those questions on particle physics and medieval history, I know, but a lot of us are left in the dark, and so you can't do that play along thing, which I think people really value in quiz programs these days. You can on the chase. That's why I like The Chase. I sit with my wife or sometimes my father-in-law, and we'll have a go, especially when it's against the clock, because you can genuinely do what the participant's doing. You can't really do that on University Challenge.
No, and there is no of that word that you like to use in when talking about quiz shows. There is no Jeopardy in University
Challenge.
No,
that's right, exactly. Jeopardy is absolutely crucial in a game show format. They would argue, of course, this isn't a game show. This is something a bit more akin to Mastermind. But on Mastermind, there's a general knowledge round which you can have a bash at. But this is incredibly specialist academic stuff, and it leaves you a bit, good luck to you. So when they answer, was it Sigmund Freud? And Passman goes, no! And you think, if he'd have gone, yes, that's right, I would have been none the wiser. It's not like you can roar at the telly, come on, of course it's not Sigmund Freud, it's Carl Jung, you fool. You can't really do that, and that takes a lot of the pleasure out of it.
Presented by Jeremy Paxman, produced by Irene Daniels, this is University Challenge. It's on BBC Two on Mondays at 8 p.m. That squeaking noise. We're going to get some WD-40 on this soapbox. That's the executive producer, accompanied this week by Brian Friedman from the X Factor, bringing in your soapbox and inviting you to clamber on board
week. Well, here I go. I'm getting onto the soapbox. This week I was proved right. Now, often that is a pleasurable experience. But I was not pleased to be proved right this week. I do online banking. I think everybody does online banking, don't they, these days? A great majority of people do online banking. And over the last 2 or 3 years, I've managed to get myself locked out of my online bank. Now, I'm not a conceited fellow. I'm a modest fellow. So I'm always more than happy to blame myself for doing something wrong when I'm operating these systems. And I just thought that 2 or 3 times a year I managed to get myself locked out, it was because I, like an idiot, forgotten what I was supposed to be putting in, what the password was, what the security ID was, etc., etc. So the last time I had to have it, you have to have it reset, you see. This is the point. They have to send... Right. All new details out through the post on a piece of paper. Good grief. I thought this was the paperless internet age, but anyway, this is what they have to do. And so it's a real pain when you lock yourself out. So, and that, for some God only knows reason why, takes 5 working days to send you out a piece of paper, which also appears curious in the modern era. But I also had happily bore that burden because I thought, I'm an idiot. I've forgotten the stupid logins again. So the last time I reset it all, I did... I've got to whisper this. I wrote it down. I wrote it down, Terence.
You fool.
I wrote it down. I thought, I can't go through this again. Yeah. So I wrote it down.
Okay, we got it. You wrote it down.
Yes, well, actually, I typed it into a document, then hid the details that I required in a piece of copy, and then password protected the file. So I'm not a complete idiot. I thought, okay, yeah, that could be hacked, but it's more secure than having it on a post-it above the desk, which I think most people do. So I needed to access, and this is not my everyday account. This is a different account that I'm talking about here. So I went to use this account first time in maybe 3 weeks, and this week, and I unencrypted the file, unpassworded the file. I remembered the password for that and opened up the details. I thought, ah, you don't get me this time. You can't get me this time. I've got it all written down. It's all written down.
Yeah, it's written down.
It's written down. And opened it up. Thought, I've got the details. This time I've got the details. I'm not relying on my own wonky memory. No problem. It locked me out. So, absolutely proof positive there is a flaw in the system, and that is why I've been locked out so many times over the last few years of my bank account, because something goes wrong. The problem is, have you ever tried getting your bank to admit that there's something wrong with their system? No, there can't be anything wrong with their system. You know, it's like asking T-Mobile to explain why they don't offer a signal on a train. Oh, we do offer a signal on the train. You're the fool. So I phoned them up. I'm afraid I have my login details here. It won't let me in. And they said, oh, are you putting it in wrong? No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. But this speaks to a much larger malaise, I think, which is, how many passwords do we need now in the modern era? How many things do we have to log into? How complicated is it to do so? When you're setting up an account for something as innocent as a software download, you have to create a password. You put that your new password in. Something, you know, it's got to be something I remember. So you put in the Rizillos as your password. it comes up, no, must include 2 numbers, 3 capitals, and 4 special characters. So, oh no, so now it's got to be the Rizillos 4692 !! !! I'm never going to remember that. But not only are you not going to remember that, you've got about 40 of these damn things. And then it says, never write down your password or tell it to somebody. How are you going to remember that? I can't even remember it now, and I said it 5 seconds ago. There are Zillows and some numbers and some special characters. We are absolutely locked and into this digital system, which we are then invited to access at our peril. When you get a password right, it's a matter of celebration. Hey, do you want to come round for some nibbles and some wine tonight? Oh, why? What's the occasion? I remembered my password on a website. It's absolutely nuts. There must be a better way than this. There has to be a better way than this. A universal password? I don't know. Forget the whole password thing. Can't we do something different? The only ones that work for me are the secret questions. What was your mother's maiden name? Where did your mum and dad meet? Or what year did your mum and dad get married? Whatever it is, those work because there's information you've already carrying around with you. It's not a specific code. But if you can't write it down and you can't remember it, then you're going to get locked out. Those password retrieval systems must be busier than the actual login systems. I think it is time we rethought the whole thing because it is driving me mad. And I wrote it down.
You wrote it down. This possibly is the issue. A friend of mine has a highfalutin role in a posh bank. And I had a really dull conversation with him some months ago. But he said to me, the reason that most people get locked out of their bank accounts, they say, oh, you know, it's your software's, you know, done this. And, you know, he said, it's nothing to do with that. It's because people write it down, but they write it down digitally, as you just described and hidden the file. But the mistake they made, he tells me, is that they then copy and paste.
No, I know that. I know copy and paste can be a problem. I know that. I've done that before. I've thought, I've copied and pasted, put the password, it says password not recognised, and I've typed it in my digit, and then it is. I know there's an issue with copy and paste. I wasn't doing that, I promise.
Now, I can tell you don't bank with Barclays Bank.
I don't.
Let me tell you how you gain access to your account with Barclays, because you, my friend, have experienced nothing. You know nothing.
No.
This is seriously, and I'm not adding in anything here. No. This is the process for me to just check, say, what my balance is on Barclays. I have a membership number. It starts 2010, as everybody's does. You have to put that number in. Then I have to, at a separate box, put my surname in.
Yes.
Press next, go to another screen. Yes. Have to put a password in.
Yeah,
yeah, password. That, of the ilk that you mentioned, you know, Rosillo's 93762 or whatever, right? Put that in. Get through to the next layer. You have a number code that they've sent to me. They send it to me. It's a credit card-sized little card, and it has a completely different number code that they choose, and they're going to put in. Right, get that. Then I get through to my bank account, but you think, oh, well, okay. No, I can't access it. I've then got to use the PIN Sentry system.
Oh, yeah.
And what that is, Magnashaw, is that Barclays send you, through the post, a little machine that you must keep in your house.
Yeah.
Then I've got to put my debit card into this little machine and decide whether I want to identify myself, respond or sign. I was just looking at it. And then I put the card in. It gives me a code, an 8-number code, that I've then got to input into another box in the Barclays website. Then I've got access to my bank account.
One last thing.
If I want to make a payment, say I want to send you £5, I have to use the PIN Sentry thing again for every individual payment that I make.
Oh, really?
So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 layers to get into my account, and a 6th one if I want to actually do something.
I think my slightly less long-winded, but it's getting there. It's getting the thing about logging in to log in to log in. Well, I certainly have to go through. Mm. Yes, and it fails. And that feeling of you, especially with the bank account, of you not being able to carry out the transaction is just beyond frustrating. I know it's a first world problem and all that, but it's just incredibly frustrating, because I know from bitter experience that this is going to involve 5 working days to get new details sent. Mm. And there's no telling them. There's no telling them that they've that the system's locked you out for no good reason. And I suspect this is going to happen again. And I really will reset it and write it down, because without writing it down, I've got no chance. And the people who design these systems must know, okay, we're asking for such a complicated combination of things, nobody can carry it around in their head. So why telling them to never write it down is going to work as a way in, I can't imagine. But of course, this is all to protect the banks, isn't it? Because if...
Oh, it's not to protect you, it's to protect them against having to
pay you out
back
when people raid your account. Exactly. Your convenience doesn't enter into it. But it must be a better way than this. It's getting ridiculous.
It is, you know, when the day comes that you need a password to access the Parish Council podcast, then...
We would never dream of it. We would never
We won't. No. We were talking about the X Factor earlier, and I think it's very easy to have a pop generally at the UK's most successful talent show, and I'm not going to do that. X Factor, despite critical vultures circling it and a gradual decline in ratings, it must be said, does remain hugely popular in terms of autumnal weekend evening viewing. Also, the proposal that it cheapens music, I think, is equally misplaced. I'm personally aware of many young people who've been inspired to learn an instrument, perhaps sing in public, and write songs after, for example, the success of One Direction. They genuinely have been an inspiration to a generation of young people. I really mean that. So all in all, I'm cheerily in favour of your X Factor. Of course, what's coming next? It's a huge but. A but that is underlined with a black marker pen. There's one aspect of the show that gnaws away at me. Despite all those positive elements, there's something that makes my teeth grind with woe. And that is the way the singers are treated throughout the process. Firstly, there's the tortuous way in which, mainly young, aspiring singers are sifted out before they reach the live shows on television. Teenagers are told that they're eliminated, and they, you know, there's terrible tears and sadness. And then they're called back and told, oh, you're a wild card, and you are going through after all. I know everyone is aware what they're getting into, but these young people will agree to anything to get on TV. And I think some of these histrionics could cause really long-term psychological damage to people. It's the bedlam thing again. But then it gets worse. These psychologically drained remaining contestants turn up and perform each week, fair enough. But it can't be left to the public to decide which is the best. First, we have to hear from a panel of absolute goons, a lineup of twerps successfully branded as judges, with no discernible musical knowledge between any of them. Simon Cowell once got lucky in a business deal and has built a career on a pretend persona of sarcasm and sneering. Cheryl Cole, Fernandez Versini, also got lucky on a talent show. Melanie Brown also got once lucky in a girl group. Cowell's weekly critiques go something like this. I tell you what, Josh, I like you because you take risks and you set out to show who you really are. This is meaningless. It's just these platitudes. Of course, they're accompanied by whooping in the studio as if Cowell has found a cure for all the ills in the world. And if Cowell doesn't like an act, he'll pick up on some tiny little fragment from the VT that they run and tell a young person that they need to listen to their mentor. They're troublesome. They must comply. These judges, they use absolutely idiotic, meaningless phrases that I've never heard. I've worked a lifetime in the entertainment industry. I've never heard anyone say, oh, you were a bit pitchy. It doesn't mean anything, though. You started well and then you lost your way. Yeah, you did. That's of no help to anybody. You needed more strength in the harmony, Melanie Brown said last week. You know, what does she know? What does she know? None of these people know what they're talking about. X Factor, I love the singers, I don't love the judges.
No, you're absolutely right about the judges. I think, and your assessment of their claims to be on that bench are bang on. I think Cowell does, I mean, he might be a lucky guy, but he's quite a smart guy, and he does realise that, and I'm not saying it's right, but his reaction to the singers he likes and the singers he doesn't like is what his persona is built on, and one of the reasons, it's one of the reasons for watching. But I do agree with you. I actually found the six chairs round in the audio, it was really like some sort of sophisticated psychological warfare technique. Was that right? You're through, go and sit on a chair, but oh wait, hold on, there are more acts than there are chairs, so actually now you're not through, give your chair up, give it to this person, so off you go crying. And then there's not a racing certainty, but it's a very good chance that you're going to be then fetched back to go and sit on the chair. This is exactly the way psychological torture is deployed in real interrogation situations. Reprieve blame is known to be psychologically damaging. I agree with that. I think that is problematic. But most of all, you're right about the not knowing what they're talking about. Louis Walsh, when we get to this stage of the proceedings, we're at now the live finals, Louis Walsh just bellows the same thing as everybody after every performance. I hate the fact that he bellows it over the audience noise. I hate that. Yes. Absolutely hate that. The audience are drilled. We know they are at these things. There's a floor manager indicating when they should make a big noise and when they shouldn't. And so clearly somebody said, wouldn't it be great if the applause is so enormous that that Louis has to talk over. To, no, it's not great. It's really awful. I hate it. And he just bellows the same.
This is what he says.
Idiocy. Yeah, go on. Yeah,
he goes, Magnus. Yes, Magnus. Magnus. You deserve to be here. You're what this show is all about, finding a pop star, and you could get a recording contract anywhere. Magnus, that's what
you remind
says.
Me of the young... insert inappropriate person here. Yeah, yeah. You remind me of the young Winston Churchill. You remind me of the young J.M. Barrie. It doesn't matter, because they don't remind you of the young anybody at all. And... I look at Louis Walsh and wonder how he managed to get so successful, because he's, what should we say, quite a straightforward gentleman, isn't he? He's quite a uncomplex character.
Oh, yes, yes. You won't find him on University
no,
College.
No, I'm trying to be kind here, but yeah. I just think, again, he must have struck very lucky somehow, because he doesn't appear to me as somebody of great business acumen or intellectual rigour, particularly.
And you know what, Magnus? Here's Dermot O'Leary. He says, "And so, Cheryl, if you want to introduce your act, right? So, you know, we're going to the girls first, and we're going to Cheryl to introduce your act. In order to remember who she's introducing, they have to look down at their cue card.
Yeah, I know.
Here's my favourite from Swindon." It's Josh!
It's Macy Boy, yeah.
It's Macy Boy Josh. She looks down at her cue card.
I know. It is. That has stripped me before. So, do you not know? Cool. Even if you don't know, you know you're coming next. Do you not have glanced down at the card while the other stuff was going on? It's just remarkable. And the idea that Mel B is some kind of Svengali or great coacher.
When did she last have a hit, Magnus?
Yeah, exactly.
15 years?
Yeah, something like that. Famous for being well-known, Mel B, really. And, and not even the best singer in the Spice Girls.
Far
from it, yeah. So, yeah, all these things are true, but they are calculated. You know, they're put together like that for a reason. And that reason is that they figure that is the best shot they have of bringing in the audience, bringing in the numbers.
Yes. So that's my beef. I love the singers. I love seeing people getting their chance and having a go at being successful. I do wish that some of them could build a greater career than the minute that the series is finished, everybody's forgotten them. Yeah. But they're having a shot. Some people have built careers on it. You know, your Ollie Murs and your One Directions and so on have built independent careers now away from the X Factor. But it's the judges. It just makes my skin crawl.
Oh, yes. I think you'd look long and hard to find somebody to disagree with you on that one. X Factor judges, they're to drive us all crazy, but also to bring in the viewing figures, as I say. Well, there you go. Two examples of cerebral jousting to rival University Challenge, frankly, there. And we've buried them in a trench and marked that with a wooden post. On the post, it says the Pretend Soapbox, which returns next week. But sadly, that means it's time to about turn and head back to the hills. Thanks very much for listening this week. We hope you've enjoyed yourselves. We are now, we're going to see if we can hitchhike down to London. We're going round to Griff Reach Jones's house to help him and his wife pack up everything in advance of their journey outwards. But as I say, we're all back next week. Hope you can join us then. Thanks very much for listening. You are our favourite listeners. Thanks very much to Rona Martin. She did the introductions. And we will see you in round about 7 days' time, if that's okay with you. Don't forget to look out for a new edition of the Indie Wonderland with our jewels. That'll be over on the site probably as you're hearing this, or if not, shortly thereafter. But in the meantime, bye-bye.
You have been listening to a Dacre Media production.